Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did you learn about sex? If you came of age in the 1960s or later, chances are your understanding of how your body works and how you might put it to use was influenced by the work of America's best-known team of sex researchers, Masters and Johnson. They started working together in the 50s, married in 1971, and divorced amicably in 1994. But beyond those facts, the details of this fascinating personal and professional partnership have remained largely private. Thomas Mayer's new book tells their story. He is an investigative journalist for Newsday who has also written books about Dr. Spock and the Kennedy family. His latest book is called Masters of Sex, The Life and Times of William Masters and Virginia Johnson, the couple who taught America how to love. Thomas, welcome to Think.
Chris, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You first interviewed William Masters back in the early 90s, is that right?
I did. On the day of his retirement, I was asked as a science and medical writer for Newsday at that particular time to do a piece about his career. And when I got off the phone, I thought, geez, a story about a man and woman studying sex and love who are not married, then they get married, and then they get divorced. And why did that happen? And nobody seemed to know, and I thought it would make a very interesting story.
So he died several years ago, but Virginia Johnson is still very much alive.
Yes, she very much is. In many ways, she's the kind of the star of the show as well. I'm particularly fascinated by Virginia Johnson, who was a 32-year-old divorced woman with a mother of two children, who went back to school in St. Louis, Washington University in St. Louis, looking to get a college degree. And she wound up becoming Dr. Masters' partner. And I thought it was one of the most fascinating modern-day Pygmalion-like stories I've ever heard.
Yeah, it's very interesting because when they met in 1957, he was already an OBGYN and had begun conducting all this research. She didn't even have a degree.
No, she didn't. She, you know, it's funny because she kind of struggled looking for love in many ways. She got married to a man, her first husband, who was twice her age, and she later learned that he didn't want to have children. Then she always fancied herself a singer. In fact, her fondest hope was someday to be sing in the Metropolitan Opera here in New York, when she actually became the girl singer in St. Louis's one of the top jazz bands. Her husband, George Johnson, became the father of her two children. But it was a marriage that was very difficult because he was a guy who kept very late hours, and she had two children. So that marriage didn't last. But she did pick up her name. She went from Virginia Eshelman to Virginia Johnson. And she goes back to school, and that's really where the story begins, when she gets a job essentially as a secretary filling out insurance forms at the medical school at Washington University. And Masters is looking for a partner. He's just been given the okay about a year or two earlier to do what would become the largest sex experiment in U.S. history, but he needed a female partner, and she entered just at the right moment.
Yeah, what convinced him that he needed a woman on the team?
Well, Dr. William Masters was a terrific OBGYN. He was one of the top leading fertility experts in the United States. He was also a terrific surgeon. He was always fascinated by the subject, which really was almost like the holy grail among OBGYN doctors. That, in other words, how the human body responded during sex was one of the key questions that every doctor, particularly an OBGYN, faces almost every day. There's questions related to patients' sexualities. And yet medicine, organized medicine, was aware of that question but studiously avoided it because it was so politically explosive. And there were people who had tried to do it just in the very early stages, and they had their knuckles wrapped, and figuratively speaking, and they basically had their careers impacted. So Masters, who traveled in the circles of doctors who were winning Nobel Prizes, was advised to make sure that he had a very dis- distinguished career, first as an OBGYN, that he was married, that he was a senior person in an academic setting. And he accomplished all of that. And he was able to convince the chancellor of the university to allow him to do this study. It was quite a remarkable story in and of itself.
Yeah, and one thing, people have heard of Alfred Kinsey, of course, who preceded Masters and Johnson, but his research was based mostly on surveys and questionnaires as opposed to physically hooking people up to monitors.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, before Masters and Johnson came along, sex was either in the realm of religion. You would, if you had a question, you would go to your minister, to your priest, or to your rabbi, or perhaps you might go to a Freudian-trained psychoanalyst. Bear in mind, Sigmund Freud's views were at its height in America when Masters and Johnson came along. And as you mentioned, Kinsey was fundamentally a sociologist. He was a pioneer in the discussion, the public discussion of sexuality. But medicine was really absent from the debate. And this was something that Masters felt very strongly should be part of it. That, in other words, your doctor, when you ask a very simple question, should be able to answer that question. And he was determined that the study that they would perform would first understand how the body worked, and then later on they came up with therapies that also revolutionized our understanding of sexuality, that helped people fix the problems that they had. This was all part of the medicalization of sex that they ushered in, an era that we still very much live with today.
Yeah, it's extraordinary to think, Thomas, that half a century ago you could go to a respected OBGYN and he wouldn't really be able to tell you exactly what was going on.
Oh, yeah. There's a contemporary of Bill Masters still alive. He's probably about 85. And he told me a story, it's in the book, about how he felt by just giving a hug to a patient, a female patient, that somehow that was understanding, and surely it was empathetic and understanding, but these male, predominantly male doctors usually avoided the subject of sex. Bear in mind, when couples have troubles, it's either having to do with money or it often has to do with sex. And if your doctor is unequipped to provide fundamental questions, if answers to questions, then particularly Masters felt that medicine was terribly derelict in its duty to patients, and he was determined to change that.
So let's talk for a minute, very basically, about the sort of setup that he had in the lab around the time that Virginia Johnson joined him.
Sure. What happened was initially he was allowed to observe prostitutes in various different whorehouses in St. Louis and in a couple of other cities as well. He arranged that because he was the doctor for a lot of well-known patients in St. Louis, including the police chief's wife, who happened to still be alive. And she told me the story of how her husband allowed the vice squad to allow Dr. Masters to observe prostitutes. Now, the problem was that there were certain aspects of prostitutes' frequency, and without getting too clinical, he came to the conclusion that the experiences of prostitutes were not applicable to the everyday experiences of most women. So he realized that he couldn't use prostitutes as the basis of his study, and then he became stuck because he didn't know how to get everyday women into his study. He had tried to enlist the help of female doctors, but there were very few female doctors, and those that were in practice, they certainly didn't want to go near this subject. This was playing with nitroglycerin, if you will. And his wife was somebody that he tried to enlist. But they had actually had difficulty having children. In fact, his fertility techniques were used on his own wife to help bear their two children. As it turns out, Masters had a low sperm count, and he helped overcome that problem with his techniques. But now that they had two children, his wife didn't want to get involved in working at the medical school. So he needed a female partner. As a matter of fact, it was a prostitute who told him one day when he was talking about female sexual response, when this particular prostitute, who happened to also be a graduate student, earning some extra money with this sideline job, she suggested that women fake orgasmed, And he had never heard something like that. What do you mean, fake it, he said. And she explained, you know, hey, doctor, this is what happens. And here he is trying to study and understand female sexual response, and he didn't understand that dynamic of the male-female relationship. So this particular prostitute said to him, you need a female partner. So when Virginia Johnson came through the door, she first thought that she was working on a fertility study. That's what Dr. Masters was known as. She would take the case studies of couples that were having fertility problems. But as it turns out, some of these couples were also involved, these case histories were people that were involved in his ongoing studies. And it was Virginia Johnson, once she kind of got involved, fully involved in the program, who turned out to be terrifically successful in convincing ordinary, everyday women to literally be observed in a medical lab having sex.
And she, throughout their relationship together, was much better with people than he was.
Yes. Dr. Masters was almost your garden variety medical genius. He was a very hard-driving man. He was a brilliant man. He was way ahead of his time, but he wasn't necessarily a people person. He would be the first one to admit that. It was Virginia Johnson who really found her stage, if you will, in a way that she always looked for in her life. She found her stage, her life's work with Bill Masters. She's the one who helped convince all these women to get involved, literally putting instruments on their body. And internally, there was a device that was internally inserted into women that had a camera attached to it. And they were actually able to show exactly how female orgasm took place. It shattered, their findings shattered the view of Freud, who had made a distinction between a vaginal and a clitoral orgasm, and said that the clitoral orgasm was an immature orgasm. And he built a whole number of theories around this type of erroneous understanding of female anatomy. Masters and Johnson came along, shattered Freud's view, erroneous view about female sexuality, underlined the multi-orgasmic capability of women, that actually women had a greater sexual capacity than men, and they also came up with a therapy that essentially replaced Freudian psychology, Freudian psychoanalysis, by providing a therapy that took 2 weeks. It was kind of a combination of all these various different things that they had learned, as well as pieces of urology and other type of things that are now known as cognitive behavioral therapy, and they taught people how to touch one another. They began from the very beginning, and within 2 weeks, with 80% success rate, they were able to claim that they were able to solve a lot of the fundamental sexual problems that married couples had.
And part of this was the idea that for the first time they were looking at the anatomical issues involved in this and not sort of blaming the victim in the way that the Freudians had.
Oh, sure. You know, when you think about it, it made perfect sense. What they wanted to do was first understand how the body worked so that they could come up, secondly, with a therapy to fix the problems. And that was the way that Masters pitched it to the university president, who was a believer in academic freedom, and Masters made him kind of live up to his word.
Thomas Mayer is my guest. He's an investigative journalist for Newsday. His new book is called Masters of Sex, The Life and Times of William Masters and Virginia Johnson, the couple who taught America how to love. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. If you would like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible in part by SMU summer camp programs, helping kids create, design, and think in fun new ways in Plano and on the Dallas main campus. Details online at smu.edu/camp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Thomas Mayer, whose new book is called Masters of Sex, The Life and Times of William Masters and Virginia Johnson, the couple who taught America how to love. If you'd like to join us, you can send an email to think@kera.org, or you can give us a call at 1-800-933-5372. So until now, Thomas, the discussion sounds pretty normal. You have this twice-divorced mother of two who really needs a job. She goes to this lab. She's not uncomfortable with the work they're doing. But we have to stop and say that William Masters made some very unusual and there's no other word but shocking demands on her.
Well, it sure was shocking. In the process of doing the research, I learned that Bill Masters had required Virginia Johnson to have sex with him within about the first year of them working together. Now, certainly by today's standards, it would constitute sexual harassment. I asked Virginia Johnson about it, and she did agree. She agreed that she acknowledged that that she didn't want to have sex with Bill Masters, but it was kind of part of the overall understanding of sexuality. In fact, Masters pitched it to her as if he was worried about members of the staff having sex among themselves or having sex with, particularly with patients. He was aware of some of the difficulties that the Kinsey group had, and anybody who had seen the movie or read the books about Kinsey know that there was a lot of sexual interaction among the staff and among some of the patients there. He was determined not to do that. So anyway, they were observing all of this sex, as you can well imagine, in a lab late at night, observing what became 700 people over a 10-year period having different types of sex. And it was almost as if, like those old Frankenstein movies when they would show the lab and you'd see the bolts of lightning zapping across the lab or whatever, there was all this type of sexual energy that was going out. And it seems as though, from what I've learned from the various people I've talked to, is that this was almost like a spillover between the two of them, that they got involved sexually. It's pretty outrageous what Masters did, but it was something that Virginia Johnson, as a working mother with two, felt she really was not in a position to object to if she wanted to hang on to the job.
Do you think Masters was deliberately taking advantage of her? Is there any doubt about that?
Yeah, no, I don't think there is any doubt about it. And it was part of the very uneven nature of their relationship. What's really remarkable about it is that over a period of time, Masters gave Virginia Johnson a great deal of opportunity and really made her an equal in a way that most male doctors would never have dreamed of doing it. Now, I know that Virginia has said to me very early on that Bill Masters called her the princess because in many ways she was making his big dream of conducting this great experiment that would make him internationally famous. She was the one who was making his big dream come true. So in a way, he loved her for that. But obviously, there was an element of power and there was an element of unequalness that he was exploiting her, at least at the very outset. What was remarkable is that they became equals. And indeed, towards the latter part of their relationship, working in their personal and professional relationship, Virginia Johnson arguably was the person making the key decisions.
And she never did finish an advanced degree.
She never did. They always were so busy, and Virginia would say that she would try to go back, but Masters would say, oh, we can't do that right now because we're traveling around the country or we have a new book coming out. And you have to wonder to what degree Virginia Johnson was fully committed to doing that degree. I think there are certainly other people who were able in a similar circumstance to get that degree. There was attempts to get her an honorary degree, but that was resisted by a great deal of male resistance in Washington University in particular. So even though she was the one who was coming up with this therapy that was revolutionizing medicine's understanding of sex and how to deal with sexual problems, she nevertheless was doing so without a degree.
But by your estimation, although she didn't have the degree, she sort of gained the equivalent knowledge throughout the research.
Oh, she did. She had a keen insight into what made people tick, particularly as a woman who was there spending hours sometimes taking the history of couples, primarily married couples, who were having sexual difficulties. She had a very keen insight into the problems that people faced, and she was also, she had a native genius, kind of an intuitive genius about what worked, and their therapy was very practical. It was kind of a stew, if you will, of all these different influences, and only those things that were shown to work remained in the stew, if you will. And she's the one who really came up with the therapy that changed so many things.
For a while, the therapy that they recommended would include the use of sexual surrogates. And then at some point they said, no, this isn't appropriate. We're not going to do it anymore. But in fact, Masters was still using them.
Yes. Well, Masters, bear in mind, was very empathetic towards his patients. For instance, women, as a surgeon, he sometimes reconstructed the vaginas of women who had been the victims of sexual assaults. So in that same kind of empathetic way, he felt very sympathetic to male patients who were having erectile problems, and he was determined that he was going to provide some type of way for them to help out. Well, as it turns out, they recruited a number of different women who within the university community who were willing to become sex surrogates. In fact, there was one sex surrogate whose husband claimed that he didn't know about this. And at the height of Masters and Johnson's fame, he sued Masters and Johnson, and they settled it out of court. But it was something that Masters and Johnson wound up, particularly Masters, saying that it worked, but they also agreed to not do it again and later claimed that it was unethical. In fact, they had seminars about it. And in my research, even though they had disavowed the use of sex surrogates in the mid-70s, I found that even as late as the mid-1980s, they were using sex surrogates. In fact, there's a woman named Maureen Sullivan, who I interview. Everybody's on the record in my book, and Maureen tells the story of being a sex surrogate for Masters and Johnson during the 1980s.
What did it take, by the way, for you to persuade Virginia Johnson, who had been very private about all of this in her personal life, to tell you so many intimate things?
Well, the first thing was that I had sent her a copy of a book I wrote about Dr. Benjamin Spock, who had a very close relationship with his wife of 40 years, and they wound up getting divorced. And Virginia Johnson actually had met Jane Spock, Dr. Spock's wife. So I sent her a copy of the book, and that kind of convinced her to talk. Also, she was getting near, she was about 80 years old. She had toyed around with the idea of writing a memoir for almost 20 years, and she just never got around to it. And I think she felt that if she didn't tell the story now, it would never happen.
Is it true, by the way, that she is sort of publicly goes around town and calls herself Mary Masters?
Well, I think she does that because she lives a life that's very private in its attempt to not have people knocking on her door all the time. Even since the book my book came out about a month ago now, she's changed her telephone number. So, you know, she's just very careful. Her children, who guard her privacy very carefully, are the ones who are the keeper of the gates. You know, just to go back to your question about talking about her intimate life, though, I found that once she did start talking to me, she was very open. She one of the first questions I asked her, as a woman who probably knows more about sex than just about any woman in the United States, I asked her, how did she lose her virginity? And it's admittedly a pretty impudent question on my part. But she told the story of a boy with fiery red hair, is all that she would describe this boy. She wouldn't give me his name. The boy with fiery red hair, and I immediately that caught my attention because I'm the father of three sons, including two with fiery red hair. So she told me the story. She was fundamentally a farm girl in Missouri just before World War II, and she thought she was going to, everybody thought she'd get married to this boy with fiery red hair, whose name I later learned was Gordon Garrett. And the beginning of my book is Virginia losing her virginity in the Garrett family car to Gordon. She's about 15, 16, and everybody thinks they're going to get married, but she doesn't. She goes off to the big city. She thinks that Gordon is going to remain on the farm. She lives in this little small town, population 800. She doesn't want to stay on the farm, and she leaves Gordon only to find out 50 years later that Gordon became a CIA agent, that he was drafted. He got involved with World War II and traveled the world. It was one of many ironies in Virginia's life, but it was all part of not only an understanding about sex, but particularly the yearning for love and the way that people spend a lot of their life looking for love.
Did she and William Masters love each other in a way that we would recognize for a married couple?
Well, you know, in a way, I still don't know the answer to that, because I surmise that Virginia still kind of loves Masters. She would resist saying that. In fact, she argued just the opposite during the course of my book. And what was really interesting was at the key moment in their career, when they were on the cover of Time magazine, about 1971, when their book Revolutionizing Sexual Therapy came out, and they were making more money than particularly Virginia ever dreamed possible, she decided to get married to a man here in New York who was the head of a large perfume company. They made scents, basically. They put the lemon in Lemon Pledge and the cocoa in Cocoa Puffs, and they also provided the scents for a lot of perfumes. It's known as International Flavors and Fragrances. And the head of this company wanted to marry Virginia, and she wanted to get married to him. And Masters found out about this relationship. He panicked and wound up divorcing his wife of 20 years, the wife that lived in the suburbs with his two kids, so that he could get married to Virginia. And he convinced Virginia, who by that point had two teenage children, that they should stay together for essentially business reasons. So they got married, not because of love. The sexual relationship that had burned between them had kind of burnt itself out. They got married in a loveless marriage for basically business reasons. They stayed together for the next 20 years, but they were America's experts on sex and love, but they were married in a loveless marriage.
How much did she trust him?
Well, you know, I think any woman who gets married to a man who's had an affair with her would inherently have to think in the back of their mind about the faithfulness and trustworthiness of that man if they get married to. So I think there was that factor. But I think they were two very highly charged people, extremely intelligent, very sensual in their own ways. They had a supercharged relationship between them. And it was something that was incredibly pleasing to the both of them, to be on all these well-known TV shows, making a lot of money, being interviewed by people, traveling to colleges all around the world. So she trusted him in the sense that they were in this great partnership together. They were Masters and Johnson. People may forget these days, but, you know, 20 years ago, they were the brand name on sex in America. And Virginia had the equal billing along with Masters. So for her, she trusted him, I think, in more ways than perhaps she should have.
And we should say that at some point, he stopped publishing books that said William Masters, M.D., so that they would look more equal on the jacket.
Exactly. There was a lot of, I'm sure, pillow talk between them. And certainly Virginia Johnson was not only persuasive with all these volunteers who agreed to have sex in their lab, but she was also very persuasive with Dr. Masters. And he, to his everlasting credit, listened to her good ideas, and it allowed them to become internationally famous.
It is sort of interesting that her, if you want to call it a pseudonym, is his name, which she didn't take professionally when they were actually married. What do you make of that?
Well, I think Virginia Johnson is like a lot of women who allow men to define their lives. In many ways, as I mentioned before, her story is a modern Pygmalion story in the sense that Masters helped make Virginia Johnson. And she, conversely, helped Dr. Masters realize his dream. He would never have achieved what he wanted to do without Virginia Johnson's help. But she became his creature just as well. They both made one another. One together, they were much more potent as a unit than they were separately. In fact, neither one would have achieved the fame and the great success that they enjoyed without having the other.
They divorced around the time that he was about to retire. Is that correct?
They did. He had Parkinson's disease, and he went back and he decided that he was going to get married to his beloved Dodie, was her name. This was the sister of his medical school college and medical school roommate. And he wanted to get married to her, and there was a misunderstanding back 50 years earlier. And she wound up getting divorced and became available, and he decided to get married to her at roughly the same time that Virginia decided she had had enough of a loveless marriage with Masters and that she was going to get rid of Dr. Masters. He wound up divorcing her on Christmas Eve, announcing that he wanted a divorce so that he could love... so he could get married to his beloved Dodie. And then Virginia, at the end of my book, winds up looking for the boy with fiery red hair. She goes back looking for her lost love of her youth, the boy Gordon Garrett.
Hold on.
And she's trying to find out what happened to him.
We'll get the rest of that story in a minute. Thomas Mayer is with us. His new book is called Masters of Sex. We'll be back.
Funding for Think is made possible in part by SMU summer camp programs, helping kids create, design, and think in fun new ways in Plano and on the Dallas main campus. Details online at smu.edu/camp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Thomas Mayer, whose new book is called Masters of Sex, The Life and Times of William Masters and Virginia Johnson, the couple who taught America how to love. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. So, Thomas, you were telling the story of Virginia Johnson deciding she wanted to look up her lost first love, and I gather from the book that she called his sister.
She did, and I won't give away the surprise ending, but she goes looking for her lost love now that Dr. Masters, her world-famous partner who divorced her and then wound up getting married to the lost love of his youth. She goes looking for Gordon Garrett, the boy everybody thought that she would get married to, and she finds out what happened to Gordon. I won't give it away. It's at the end of the book. But it is something that I thought was really surprising to me, that even Masters and Johnson were looking for what is this thing called love. You know, I mean, in many ways, their whole professional life was geared towards what is this thing called love? Well, you know, this, particularly sex as the physical expression of love in among married couples. And yet they themselves had such a difficulty trying to figure out love and the search for it. And I thought it was a very interesting counterpoint to their professional lives, the fact that in their personal lives that they could never seem to really figure it out.
But they sound like hopeless romantics in some ways.
It is, but bear in mind, you know, think of why people get married, and there's so many different reasons for it. But we live in a culture that is obviously, we believe in the idea of a happy ending. The movies that Virginia Johnson used to watch as a young girl, of the romantic ending and the yearning for love. And that's a big part of it. You know, bear in mind, when married couples would come to Masters and Johnson seeking help, they were having difficulty with the physical expression of their ideals of love.
Did they worry at all about the public response to their divorce?
I think so, although they were fairly old in age. They were in their 70s by the point at which that became known. They never really talked about it. They kind of put on a happy front, but as I learned in my research, there was a lot more of a rivalry between the two of them at the end there. There was some hurt feelings. And even to this day, does Virginia Johnson still love Masters, this man who provided so much opportunity, this man who arguably either exploited her or made her, created her? Whether or not she still loves him is still an open question, I think, even in her mind.
Was he at all a father figure to her children?
No. He wasn't a very good father, even to his own children. And he was, as I mentioned, kind of a garden variety medical genius who felt that his place was in the lab. That was his home. This is the place where he wanted to become famous. He had come from a family where his father beat him pretty unmercifully. And he lived apart from his family by a fairly young age, by about 12 or 13. He lived in a boarding home, and he was the boy who would never go home for holidays and college and such. He would be the one who stays home. So he was a very self-driven, self-made man who was determined to make his mark and kind of prove his own self-worth by creating something that people would have to say was an act of genius, was something that would make him world-renowned. And it was Virginia Johnson who allowed him the opportunity to do so.
Yeah, there's a very interesting and poignant story in the book about how Masters was sort of unceremoniously abandoned by his father.
Yeah, it was very cruel, and one of the ironies about his life, one of many ironies, is that instead of learning from the difficult, harsh treatment that he got from his father, he was emotionally very distant from his children, particularly his oldest son, who I interviewed for the book, who is a lovely man who's quite accomplished. He's an ABC News producer here in New York, but he really was very brought up by his mother, not by Dr. Masters, who was usually working or traveling nationally or internationally. He was busy being the famous Dr. Masters, but he wasn't much of a father at home.
Can you talk for a minute about how people responded when this research first started coming out and the way that things started to change, just in terms of the way Americans talked about sex?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, people were seemingly starved for very basic information about sex. Masters and Johnson would tell this story of one couple that they advised who actually thought they could become pregnant by literally sleeping in the same bed. They didn't realize that sexual intercourse was part of it. That's an ignorance that is almost hard to believe. And yet, although not as profound as that, there was a great degree of ignorance about sex when Masters and Johnson started. One of the things that they did was that their books were very clinical. They used a lot of medical terms, and it allowed the popular newspapers and women's magazines to essentially imitate their approach by using the medical terms. And a lot of the discussion about sexuality in the popular culture did not become part of everyday understanding until Masters and Johnson came along. And then you can see it in the newspapers and in the women's magazines. Suddenly they had columnists devoted to explaining sexuality. In fact, even Playboy magazine, which provided a lot of information about male sexuality, had never talked about the clitoris, as an example, a key part of female sexuality, until there was a question and answer with Masters and Johnson in 1968 in Playboy magazine. By that point, they had been in business for 12 or 13 years, and yet they had never mentioned such a key part of female anatomy, sexual anatomy. So they revolutionized our understanding about sexuality. They brought medicine into the fore, and they were later aware of the importance of love involved with sexuality. In fact, they almost thought that things got too far away, that this revolution that they helped inspire went too far. And some of their later books made sure to emphasize the component of love and the emotion involved in our understanding of successful sexual relationships. And yet, in their own lives, of course, they had had that same difficulty.
They did study homosexual sexuality, which would sound progressive for the time, but in fact they reached some conclusions that today are largely discredited and to many people quite disturbing. Can you talk about that?
Sure. The third large book was about homosexuality. And in that book, one of the things that they contended was that their therapy, which had been terrifically successful with heterosexual couples in particular, had an 80% success rate, and was by that point in 1979 was created this huge sex therapy industry. The therapists using their techniques all around the world in medical schools and such. They came out with a book on homosexuality that said that their therapies were potent enough, powerful enough, that if a patient wanted to, a patient could change their sexual orientation from homosexuality to heterosexuality. Often these were, for instance, men who were secretly gay but had married and yet were happy with their spouses but were not having sex and wanted to have heterosexual sex. And Masters felt strongly that these patients had a right to be helped as well. However, what I found in my research is that the so-called gay conversion cases were not really true, that a number of the staffers who I interviewed said they had heard about it but had never witnessed it. People who put together the schedules and such had never heard about it. And one of the key doctors, their number two doctor, said to me that there were no records for it, and it alarmed him, and he went to Virginia Johnson. Virginia Johnson at that point had somewhat removed herself. This is not to excuse her lack of responsibility here, but she and this other doctor, Dr. Robert Kolodny, attempted to stop the book from being published. It was too far along in the process, and Virginia Johnson, who was married to Masters at that point, kind of went along with it. In fact, they were on Meet the Press for an entire episode of Meet the Press in which Masters claimed that they could change the sexual orientation of people. She went along with it. When I interviewed her about it, she now says it's a bad book and that Masters was kind of dealing with the onslaught of Parkinson's, that is, that his judgment was poor in that circumstance. But unfortunately, this has caused a lot of problems for a lot of people.
Do you have evidence other than this book that William Masters was probably a homophobe?
No, I don't think he was a homophobe, believe it or not. He was crucial in helping psychiatry drop the designation of homosexuality as a mental disorder about 5 years before this book came out. No, I think he was more motivated to help these patients, I don't think there was an animus or a hidden agenda against homosexuals. However, I think, unfortunately, this claim of gay conversion has been embraced by a lot of different religious and political groups who have claimed that Masters and Johnson said that you could change your sexual orientation so if you really wanted to. And so they've adopted Masters and Johnson's claims as their own. It's caused a lot of difficulty for people. There are some cases in which people have talked about suicide, having gone to these boot camps of ex-gay boot camps in which people were compelled by loved ones to go to try to change this sexual orientation. Organized medicine has disavowed this, and yet there's still a number of people out there who still use this gay conversion approach that Masters and Johnson claimed worked.
Let's go very briefly to the phones and speak to Wanda in Corsicana. Hi, Wanda.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you.
I was listening to the program, and Virginia Johnson, the name, it occurred to me that I wonder if part of her success or her acceptance was maybe an unconscious on people's part, because her name, first and last, are euphemisms for, well, human genitalia.
Yeah, I don't think that had anything to do with it. I think that the acceptance of Masters and Johnson had to do with the fact that that it was a man and a woman. Masters would often say that he would have been perceived as a pervert with a clipboard, that was his phrase, if he didn't have a female partner. And it was Virginia Johnson's willingness to go along that really helped make the success of Dr. Masters. It was something that was very unheard of for its time. Bear in mind, women were virtually non-existent in medicine in the 1950s, even the early 60s. Virginia Johnson's pioneering of female sexuality, I think, is one of the key points of my book. I think she really helped pioneer the type of sexuality that a lot of young women today that we see on shows like Sex and the City and that we see in women's magazines. I think she's the one who said that women should have the same rights and have the same independent-mindedness about their sexuality that men have enjoyed for hundreds of years.
Did you have a chance to ask either one of them in the interviews that you had over the years what they thought about today's sort of TV and radio and newspaper column sex therapists?
I did. You know, Virginia Johnson, I think, was particularly interested in the women like Madonna, as an example. She used Madonna as an example of a woman who had created herself, that she was her own independent-minded woman in all aspects of life, including her sexuality. I think Virginia Johnson lived like a nice girl. She played the game as that most women would do in the 50s and the 60s. But she was determined privately that she would set her own agenda. So she's been admiring of younger women, particularly today, in the independence and the freedoms that they enjoy to make up their own minds about the lives they'll lead.
Thomas Mayer's new book is called Masters of Sex, The Life and Times of William Masters and Virginia Johnson, the couple who taught America how to love. Thomas, very interesting stuff. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you so much, Chris. Take care. Have a great day.
Thanks. My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.